Welcome to another Patreon bonus episode of the Prince Kaifan Pod. My name is Bethany Finger, and today's special guest is Leah from YA Book Chat.
Hi.
And we are going to do our first ever ship episode. This will be a recurring theme going forward, but today's ship is Caresswell.
Yes, my favorite one.
So then the perfect one to discuss. So I'm going to do a quick, if you are listening to this episode, you are a Patreon member for a Lunar Chronicles podcast, which means I don't know how you wouldn't know who Caresswell is, but let's pretend for 1 second that I have to give context to what's going on. In the Lunar Chronicles, we have what are called ships, which is a relationship within the series between two characters, usually a romantic involvement. In today's particular episode, we will discuss the relationship between Captain Carswell Thorin and Cress Darnell, whose relationship sort of started in book three of the Lunar Chronicles entitled Cress and goes forward all the way into the graphic novels, Stars Above and the COVID short story. And we assume into the future beyond that as well.
I would hope so.
So we have quite a few topics that we're going to go over. And a couple of them were suggested by Patreon members on the Discord. So thank you for participating in that. And remember, for future bonus episodes, you can always leave your commentary there if you would like it to be included in the episode discussion. So let's start with Cress. Cress grew up isolated on the satellite, away from other people, away from outside resources, this tiny little fishbowl where all she had was herself and the computer, and every once in a while a visit from Sybil, who was her captor for all intents and purposes. So how has Cress's isolation and time on her satellite impacted her view on love?
Well, she doesn't really know what love is, what true love is, because she doesn't have parents. She was taken from her parents, and she's just grown up all by herself on this satellite with, like you said, just visits from Sybil from time to time. And Sybil, by all means, is like no way loving at all. You know, Sybil is like her boss in a way, you know, and her captor. And so Cress, all she has are her vid screens where she can watch all the feeds of things happening on Earth and other places and on Luna. But like, that's all she sees. And she can like Google people. I mean, Google and their version of Google. But like, yes, but she has no real interaction with people. All she has is like the voice of little Cress that she recorded, who kind of keeps her company, but that's the computer. So she doesn't really know what love is in any form.
Yeah, her only interactions with another like living human are with Sybil, who is so disgusted with shells in general that she intentionally avoids touching Cress unless she's, taking her blood samples. So first thing I want to point out is that Cress has grown up in a life where she is extremely touch starved, which can cause very severe trauma and depression. Then we also have to take into consideration, like you mentioned, her only exposure to love or its concept is the definition, how it's represented in forms of entertainment, like books and TV shows, and her connection with the AI that she created. So I think it had a huge impact on her concept of love, not just like on her view of love or if she wanted to find it for herself, but like the very concept of what it means to be loved or to extend love to another person.
Right. Because she doesn't really know what any of that means.
Right.
She's never experienced it.
No, and it's interesting to take into consideration that Cress and Thorn were both in isolation. Thorne had been put in solitude in prison for, I think, 18 months. And so Cress had a much longer time in isolation, longer, with far less exposure to, or with far more exposure to outside resources, where Thorne was in, you know, the only person he saw were his guards, and he tricked one of the attractive ones into giving him a port screen. But there is, I don't think there's enough discussion about the fact that Thorne, for at least a brief period of time, was also in isolation.
Right. I hadn't thought about that either, but yeah, I mean, they have that in common, definitely, and that's going to make a big difference for both of them.
Do we think, since we're looking at this out of curiosity, do we think that prior to developing a connection with Cress, and even a platonic relationship with the rest of the Rampian crew, do we think that Thorne had a clear idea of what it meant to be loved and to extend love?
I think he has a very confused version of it, you know, because he doesn't really have any friends.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, he's a solo, he does things on his own with all of his thievery and whatnot. And I mean, he's like, he's been with other women, because he talks about that in the book, but he even says he wasn't in love with them. It was more of like, he charms women, or people really, to get what he wants, which is totally different. He might have, like, you know, think that certain women are beautiful and, you know, have a fling with them, but it's definitely not love at all.
Yeah. Very superficial, very surface level. I would say that if anything, his exposure to the misconception of love gives him sort of a parallel, or maybe even an opposite, you know, interpretation than Cress, right? Cress only has the other people. Cress has the false experience, not false. What do I want to say? Okay. Cress's interpretation of love comes from people imitating it. Whereas Thorne's interpretation of love comes from himself imitating it on a surface level with these partners he's had over the years. So they both have sort of a warped view of love. I don't think either one of them knows or understands that concept until they've developed a relationship with each other. And I think what's not talked about enough is Thorne's platonic love and affection that he develops for the crew, especially Cinder. Because there's a big, like, friendship bond there that cements in place very quickly. Like, pretty much as soon as he goes to the farm and he sees, like, what happened to her as a child, and then he realizes that she was that child, like, that's pretty much the start of Thorne really starting to open up and extend sympathy to Cinder. And I think that sympathy extends to respect, to fondness, to love and affection. So I think that there's a platonic balance that we don't discuss enough as well.
Yeah, he definitely is able to develop a really great relationship with Cinder, especially, like you said, and even the rest of the crew too. Although it is funny sometimes the way he refers to, like, Wolf and Scarlet, but he still does have that bond with them. You know, and how could you not, with what all of they're going through and trying to accomplish, and how they're forced, you know, they've got this forced proximity, they have to be working together. So he's got them, but he's got, you know, that type of love, the friendship love, but he's not, his, you know, experience with the opposite sex, as far as romantic love goes, has been very surface level.
Right. So Cress quickly forms an infatuation with Thorne from the very beginning, even before they meet. How does she deal with the unrequited love? And what advice would you give to someone going through this themselves? So she's the ultimate fangirl who got the ultimate, like, crush.
right?
She's what we all want, right? Like you have a crush on someone that actually goes somewhere. And from a personal standpoint, I remember like when I first started crushing on my husband and we were friends first, and like the amount of anxiety of like, did that extra hug mean something to him? You know, is he always sitting next to me at events? Like, is there a reason for that? Am I reading too much into it? Because like, I want to read into it. So like, I do think there's something to say about her infatuation, like impacting what happens before they meet and when they meet. I mean, even just when she sees him on the screen, she like hides under the desk.
Oh my gosh, which is hilarious. And I love that. And he's like, hello. It was so funny.
Yeah.
But she definitely, you know. It says like he was exactly the kind of hero she'd been dreaming about her entire life, you know, and she's just been on this satellite. She like stares at his pictures on the net screen and then he's there like in person.
You know what I think is really interesting? The reason that Cress thinks of Thorne as a hero is because of all the heroic actions he's done. But something beautiful that we learn is that Thorne sort of explains to her like, oh yeah, that heroic thing I did was self-serving. And this heroic thing I did was self-serving. And this heroic thing I did was self-serving. And Crest thinks to herself, but what about everything you did for us in the time since we met, especially in the desert? Because that was all heroic and it wasn't necessarily self-serving and it wasn't necessarily, you know, false.
Right.
So if you take that into consideration, it's more than her interpretation of his past as being heroic. It's what she saw and experienced in the desert when he rescued her, when he did what he could to save her, when he came to the African town to rescue her from the people that had captured her as shells, when he kissed her on the balcony so that she wouldn't die without being kissed, when he held her while she cried over a father she didn't know. I mean, like all of those things are heroic and those are experiences that she actually had with him. So while I don't, I do think there's something to be said about her walking in with a certain expectation from him and a certain, maybe impression of who he is as a human. I think once she actually met him, he had already changed so much just from knowing Cinder, that he was the hero she always saw anyways, and he just didn't realize it.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't look at himself as a hero at all, you know, and she's never met him, but she's got him, you know, before they meet up on this like really high pedestal, you know, and like, so she's already there. This is a picture. And he's just kind of like, that's a lot to live up to, you know? Yeah. And like, I've never even met you, yet you know all this stuff about me and you're infatuated with me. And I don't know what to do with that. You know, like he doesn't know how to deal with that. Cause for him, it's probably always been the opposite where, you know, he's seen a beautiful woman and gone up to her and you know, whatever. And so now this is the opposite because she's like knows all the things about him. And even though they hadn't met in person yet, she like, as soon as they do, she's like totally infatuated with him and he just can't process that, which makes sense, you know? So
that's a lot of expectation. That's a lot of expectation to live up to.
Right. Yeah. So it's no wonder he's very, you know, I mean, he's very, I don't want to say standoffish, but he's just tries to like push her away a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't necessarily say he's standoffish. I think that he's reserved in an attempt to protect her and himself from an emotional attachment that one, he doesn't think he kind of deserves, but the other side of that is that he also doesn't think Crest deserves it in the opposite way, right? Like he thinks Crest deserves better and he thinks he is undeserving.
Right. Right. And he doesn't, cause he doesn't think highly enough of himself, which is really sad.
Yeah.
But she like, I feel like she takes his, you know, the unrequited love, like in her stride. She takes it in her stride, and she like doesn't give up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She doesn't push it, but she doesn't necessarily give up. She just kind of lets their relationship develop as it will. And they do have a bunch of different moments. But unrequited love is not easy. It's really tricky because, I mean, and I've been there, you know, but it's like you have to figure out a way to maintain a friendship or, you know, relationship of some sort with that person, even though you are really like pining after them and they don't feel that way. You have to figure out, how can I stay friends with this person or connected to this person, but be okay with the fact that they aren't in love with me?
We kind of already answered the next two questions through our discussion. So let's move on to, what are some airplanes?
Yep.
What are some of our favorite Cresswell moments throughout the series? And I want to include any moments that are in the graphic novels, the Stars Above short stories, and even the COVID 128 short story.
Okay. So I looked at a lot of mostly from this book, but
which is fine. I just want to leave it open that you can include anything you want.
Okay. There are so many different points. Like, some of them were just like little funny moments that I really like. Mm-hmm. You know, and some we have this like really sweet and tender moments. It's kind of a funny moment when like she, when they're hiding and she like, when, or when the pod is going to crash, and she like pulls him under the bed with her and they're trying to hide under there, but they're having like this whole like crazy kind of conversation at the same time. And then they're under the bed, right? And he's like, wants to get out from under the bed. And he says, I think we should. And like, her thought is like, is he going to kiss me? Because isn't that what people do after they've survived a thrilling near death experience together?
Yeah.
So it's kind of this like silly moment. But I thought, you know, it's kind of a fun moment too. But of course, then their real kiss I should say real one, like when he kisses her when they're afraid they're going to die and he doesn't want her, you know, he promised her that she wouldn't die without being kissed. That's a really fun moment. Like, cause it's not our true, like they're in love with each other first kiss. Right.
Right. They sort of get to have two first kisses in that way.
Yes, they do. But it's, yeah, but this one is, it's fun too, just because he's being so sweet and it totally took her off guard, you know, and he doesn't just like give her a peck either. He really like, he dips her down. He really gives her this big fun kiss. So those are, let's see. I have other ones too, but you say some of yours while I'm looking through my book here.
So right off the top of my head, my absolute favorite Cresswell moment is when they're in the plane, when they're on the Rampian and she is dealing with the loss of Dr. Erland, who she learned was her father, learned he died, and then had to process within like a 4 minute period, literally like 4 to 5 minute period. Mm-hmm. And I think that is just such an incredible moment of vulnerability from both of them, because Thorin is not the one to reach out and comfort another person. That is not something that comes naturally to him. And Cress is always like sort of touch starved, like I mentioned earlier. So having someone that even is willing to comfort her in a physical way is extremely mm-hmm. emotional and sort of adds to that emotional experience. So that is probably one of my favorite moments, the two of them sitting on the Rampian and she's like in his lap and she's just sobbing and he's just there for her in the only way that he knows how to be. And it's before It's after what I would consider their each of them realizing that those feelings are much deeper than they thought.
Yeah.
But it's before anything is actually vocalized or expressed.
Right. I really like too when they are in the desert and Cress kind of starts panicking a bit, and he just sits there and he, you know, puts his arm around her and he says, you know, we're not going to die here. Like he's trying to reassure her, and it's very soft and gentle because he can see how upset she is and how distraught she is and that she thinks that there's no hope. And he just very gentle is like, we're not going to die here in the desert. I promise you, I'm going to take care of you. You know, we're going to get through this, and I've survived much worse, which means we can survive this together. And so I just feel like that was like a really nice, sweet kind of moment too, that I really like a lot.
And then, of course, I also really, well, we love the first kiss. That's mm-hmm. a given, I think. But I also love the end when he, of the end, the end of Winter, when he says, like, look, I don't think I deserve you, but rather than giving up on our potential, I'm going to do what I can to deserve you in the future.
Yes. That's like the best thing ever.
Yeah.
I mean,
because we've seen a version of Thorne who would self-sabotage and be like, well, I don't deserve you, so this relationship is over. But now we see like right. a stronger version of Thorne who says, I don't think I deserve you, but that doesn't mean that I can't change myself and grow and mature as a person so that I do deserve you. And I think there's probably something to be said about the concept of deserving people and matching with the right person and picking a partner for yourself. But I also think that there's a certain amount of choice involved going forward. Like I know, for example, that I have been told, oh, you're so lucky that your husband is like, you know, isn't misogynistic or something like that. And I'm like, that's not luck. I chose a partner that had the same moral compass as myself. I chose a partner who had the same values as myself. That's not luck. It might be luck that I met him. That could, you know, you can bring in a question right. of like destiny or something, but it's not luck. It's not, I just so happened to marry someone and he just so happened to have those same core values. Like that was a decision both of us made. And so I do think that this is an important moment for their relationship going forward. Thorne is vulnerable enough to be like, these are my shortcomings, but he's also brave enough to be like, but I'm going to do something about them.
Right. And that's fantastic. I mean, that's what it is to be in a relationship and how you make it work too.
And that's a relationship with yourself as well. There's a lot right. of self-care and a lot of self-love that goes into wanting to be a better person and to wanting to understand yourself better.
Right.
So let's talk about some of our least favorite moments. Can I just speak for everyone in the fandom and say the gambling is that's the worst scene ever.
Yes, it is.
In the words of Quentin Finger, he's a fuckboy in that scene. I swear to you, we were in the car listening to the audiobook and he paused it and he goes, what a fuck boy.
That is hilarious. that is seriously like the worst moment.
So especially, terrible.
I mean, especially because, not just because she sees it, right? Which he doesn't know, but also because he is putting them in danger.
Right, because he's supposed to be on his honeymoon.
Right, they're supposed to be married. And then he's down there where anybody from the caravan could see them with mm-hmm. this, you know, escort droid all over him. And then he's like, oh, no, I'm just trying to win it for a friend, which he is, but they're not going to believe that. You know, so like it looks
even
really
if he
bad.
Were trying to win it for a friend, she doesn't have to sit on her lap. She doesn't have to blow on her dice. She doesn't have to right. like he doesn't have to flirt with her.
Right.
So, I mean, whether whether or not Cress saw them, it was dangerous and it was careless. Right. And Cress being collateral damage is horrible. But I think that even if we wanted to be like, well, Thorne probably thought she wouldn't see them because she's upstairs, or even that Thorne might not have thought of that because it didn't occur to him that it might hurt another, that his actions romantically might hurt another person. It was careless in the fact that it completely blew their cover, which we see in a later scene.
Right. Yeah. Because then, and her seeing it too is kind of what leads her to leave with the woman from the caravan, which is when they essentially kidnap her. So
right.
he did a lot of, he set a lot in motion there from one stupid thing that he did.
I think also what we see in this scene is a plot device. Mm-hmm. So there's an argument to be made of like, well, could Marissa have done something different in this scene to separate them? But I think that this scene was actually necessary for Thorne's character growth.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So do you have any least favorite moments besides that one?
I do, actually. So
bring it.
Okay. Another one, okay, that I really struggle with is later. It's closer to the end of the book. When they're talking and then he tells her about the incident with that 13-year-old girl that he was helping, like with math or whatever, and how that
when he was also 13.
Right.
I'm sorry.
And then,
like, from the surface, it's like when the 20-year-old was helping a 13-year-old.
No.
When they were both teenagers.
Yes, when they were 13, and he was, you know, copying her homework, whatever. So he comes clean about that, and then they're talking about their kiss, Cress and Thorne's kiss, but it's like there's just this like tension between them in this scene, and he's essentially kind of like, you know, it's like they're talking like they want to express their feelings but they don't at the same time, and it's really hard. And he says this stuff to her, and then she's like, but you know, she loved him even more than ever, and he thinks like she's going to be disappointed. And then he brings up, you know, the kiss and if it met her expectations, and she's like, yes. But there's just this thing that like hangs in the air, because then he says, you know, she's like, I feel like I should say thank you, and he says, no, you know, the pleasure was all mine, which is fantastic. And of course it's going to put her in her head even more. But then it's like, that's where it ends. And you're just like, no, you need to express feelings here, because I know that there's more feelings here and you're not saying them, either one of them. And it's just kind of like,
agreed. I would also argue that some of it is influenced by his experience with hollow relationships, because perhaps he knows the damage they can cause. Because all of his relationships in the past have been hollow. And so maybe he's like, well, she's never even had a relationship. Like, her first experience shouldn't be something that doesn't mean anything.
Okay, so here's the thing. I don't think he was oblivious to her feelings at all. Like, he knew that she had the feelings, okay? But I think it was a little of both of these things. I think that he definitely, at the beginning, views them as childish fantasies a little bit, just because of how much she talks about him and says he's a hero right away, even though they've never met before. And because she, like, you know, looked up and knows all of these things about him, but she doesn't really know that, you know, what was the truth behind it. So I think that a little bit, he does kind of think them childish, but at the same time, I think it's more that he's just uncertain about himself and doesn't feel like he deserves that admiration from her because he doesn't see himself as a hero. He doesn't, like, that's a big, you know, like we said before, she puts him really up on a high horse and he just doesn't feel like he is a hero and like he deserves that because he's done so many other, like, you know, bad things. And he had all these other kind of nefarious intentions behind them. So it's like, he doesn't feel like he deserves her admiration. So, you know, he pretends like he knows she's got feelings for him. It's very obvious, but he just, I think, you know, tries to push it aside a little bit at first because of the childishness, because they've never met. But then I think it's mostly because he doesn't feel like he deserves that from her. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. So he's, yeah, and he's afraid that that's all it'll be with him. So, yeah. We did? We didn't talk about the when.
We know that Cress falls immediately for Thorne before they even met. But when do we think Thorne falls for Cress? And how is this love unconventional? And because Cress fell for him before they met, does this mean she fell twice?
Okay. So as I was reading through the book, there's like two different spots here where I was like, okay, I think that maybe like when they're in the desert and she gets sick, like right before they get picked up by the caravan, I feel like that's when he like first maybe starts to kind of have a little bit of feelings for her because he is so concerned about her at that point and it's very clear. But the clincher for me, I think, is when she gets kidnapped. I think that that is when we have like full recognition of like, even for him, that like, oh my God, she's gone. What's going to happen to her? I'm really concerned and upset. I think that was like a big point where he really, well, I mean, maybe for him even realizes, you know, how much he cares about her because of that. But I think he starts to fall in love with her when she first gets sick in the desert. And the thing is that, I mean, because you got to love this, right? Like they're in the desert. He's totally blind. He's completely dependent upon her. He needs her so much. And so, you know, they have to have this, they have to have a good relationship in order to make it work. But yeah, when she gets sick is when he, I think he really starts to realize and have feelings for her because all of a sudden we see that he's really starting to, he's concerned about her. He's concerned about her.
I would say so. Yes, but.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I want to know what you think.
I do think all of that is a precursor. I think it's the first kiss on the roof. I think he kissed her for more than one reason. I think leading up to that point, he was already starting to fall for her, and that was the catalyst. I think he kissed her for two reasons. One, because he was supposed to. He promised he would, but I think part of him right. didn't want to die without kissing her.
Oh, I agree. He definitely wanted to kiss her.
Would have been really easy for him to forget that promise considering they're about to die. And there's like a lot of other stuff going on. But I think that when he thought about like, we might not survive this, I think part of his emotions were like, we might not survive this. What does that mean for me? It means that not just would he break his promise to her, but that he would never know what it was like to kiss her to be with her in that way, to have that intimate moment. Yeah. And I think that that culminated with the actual kiss and how it like impacted him and how it felt for him. I think those two cemented what might be what we would actually consider like love, and not just, you know, that he cares about her, that there's an infatuation there or something. I think that cemented all of his past growing points where he had started to care about her. So everything you mentioned, I think, is like the beginning of him starting to care about her. And I think the kiss, the very first kiss, is that catalyst. And maybe not even the kiss itself, but the decision to do the kiss.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point too. Because then again, going back to that conversation that I was talking about earlier, you get the feeling that, like, you know, when she says thank you for the kiss and they're talking about the kiss, you know, he says, oh, good, you know, because if it didn't meet your expectations, I'd feel like a real big cad. But
yeah,
I feel like that's just him kind of covering his emotions, because then at the end, you know, he says, believe me, the pleasure was all mine. And it's just like the phrase of it. And with that conversation, it just feels like he really wanted that and he really enjoyed it. And he is now like acknowledging these feelings for her.
There's also a moment of self-preservation there, because he says, if it was a bad kiss, you could just say so. Because, and I think he says that.
He does.
This is the part where she says, like, I'm beginning to think that maybe great epic romances don't just happen. We have to make them ourselves. Thorne shuffled his feet. You know, if it was a bad kiss, you can just say so. To me, that's a defense mechanism.
Oh, totally.
To me, we don't get this in his perspective, but if we were to have it in his perspective, I think it's plausible that he feels like in that moment, that kiss cemented his feelings for her, but it made her realize that hers maybe were childish fantasies.
Well, because,
and so I feel like he's, go ahead.
Because he asks her, so given all this new information, you probably don't think you're still in love with me, do you? And she doesn't answer. Yep. And so he's like, oh, you know, I guess that's what I thought. I figured it was just the fever talking, but she doesn't, that's the part that really, I was like, Chris, say something. But that's like self-preservation for both of them right there. You know, like what you were just saying with him.
And that's why I think the kiss is what made him realize that his feelings were deeper than even he realized. And then this part, you know, this part is kind of heartbreaking, because I think in Thorne's perspective, that kiss cemented his feelings for Cress. But he's worried that for her, it was just a realization of my feelings for Thorne really are, you know, fantasy and not real. And because of that, he goes into self-preservation, worried about, well, no longer does she love me, so no longer will I put myself out there. She goes into self-preservation because she thinks that kiss meant more to her than it did to him. Okay, so in addition to everything we just talked about, do we think Cress fell for him twice? Once before they met and once after?
Okay, here's what I think. Because even though she had done like all the research and everything on him, you know, and she thought that she knew who he was, and she had a huge crush on him, obviously, because of how he looks, I feel like it was just that the first time, you know, it was a crush that she had on him, because she doesn't really know him, you know. But then when she does meet him and has this whole experience with him and gets to know him, then I feel like that's when she actually like really falls in love with him, because it's not just this ideal or this, you know, person that she's built up in her head. It's somebody who's real and tangible and right in front of her, and who she's gone through all of these things with. And so even though he's told her, you know, those moments that she thought were heroic really weren't, she's still, you know, fallen in love with him now because of what he really did, all of his actual heroic moments and everything that they've gone through. So I think, you know, at first it's really just more of like a crush, but then I think after she meets him is when she actually really falls in love with him.
I agree, but I want to add something. I don't think she falls twice. Maybe she falls 1.5 times, because I want to give her credit, because the first time that she does have all those feelings of infatuation, they're misconstrued. It's not real love, but she thinks it is. And I don't want to discredit, you know, that emotion that she has. So I'm going to give her 1.5.
Okay. That makes sense.
Because Thorne doesn't have a clear picture of what Crest looks like, he falls for her personality and not her looks. How is this different from the other girls, aka the 24, who he said, "I love you" to? I think we already talked about this, that those relationships were hollow and surface level and based almost entirely on looks.
Exactly. And, or, you know, what he could get from them. Yeah, this is a much more deeper connection.
I also would argue that, you know, we've talked a lot about how Cress, like, had an infatuation and a crush, and that her feelings for Thorne weren't as fully developed in the beginning as they are much later. But what we should acknowledge is that every relationship Thorne has ever had has been based on that in the past. So, you know... Right. Whether it was him crushing on them or them crushing on him, it was always infatuation before, which he realizes when he understands that he actually does love Cress. And I think for those of you listening who are, you know, maybe a little bit younger or maybe not as experienced in love, I don't want to speak for everyone, but from personal experience, even if you did love somebody in the past, I think, and maybe not even just marriage, but like a long-term relationship can really change your perspective of love in general. Because I can tell you right now, I loved my husband when we got married. I really did. But I like love my husband now. Like 10 years in to marriage, 13 years into being together. We met 15 years ago. Like I have loved him through multiple phases of his life and vice versa. And I can tell you right now, the emotional connection I have with him now is so much stronger than that day when I realized I was in love with him. And I don't know if that's the same for everybody, but I just feel like it's a completely different level and a completely different experience to anyone that I had before.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what happens, you know, like the longer that you're with somebody, that love is going to grow and change in a lot of different ways. So it does become deeper the longer you're with that person.
Point out that when you are in love, it's different for every person, first of all, even if you're in the same relationship. But I would also say that when you realize you're in love with someone, like when you realize you love someone is sort of different than when you realize you've fallen in love with someone, I think. You know, it's what we just talked about realizing that you care about someone. That's still a form of love. Realizing that that love is romantic is kind of a bigger moment, I think. And I would venture into saying that Thorne maybe did have moments with these women where he cared about them. And so he mistook that caring for love. And it wasn't until he experienced the real act of like romantic love that he felt with Cress that made him realize anyone he thought he loved before meant nothing compared to what he feels for Cress. And therefore it wasn't real.
Right. He goes through a lot. He really grows a lot and learns a lot about himself.
Yeah, I would argue that Thorne has the most character growth and development of the entire series. And you can at me on that. That's a hill I'll climb.
I agree. No, I completely agree with you on that. I am on your side.
And that's not to negate the character growth or experience of anybody else in the series. I just think that if we had to measure it in a quantifiable amount, Thorne would have the most. Period.
Yep.
Yeah.
He does. Exactly.
Okay, so Kai and Thorne share a bro moment in book 4 where they help each other through their girl problems. First, how do they help? And second, do you think it's important to have a support system when it comes to relationships?
I absolutely love this scene in Winter. This is one of my favorite moments. It's just, it's really fun because they're both, you know, talking about, because, you know, Kai goes first, of course, and they're talking about all the things with Cinder. And then he just like flicks it over all of a sudden, you know, to like, to Cress, because they talk about what's going to happen, you know, after everything is over and, you know, if the crew is going to stay with him or not. And Thorne's like, well, everybody's going to be going somewhere else. And then, but he doesn't mention Cress. And so of course, Kai brings up Cress.
Who gets the berry
and,
too.
You know, asks what's going on with him.
Because.
Yeah. So.
Andrew.
Does she really call me her girlfriend?
I love when he's like, and your girlfriend. And Kai is like, yes, my girlfriend. Yeah.
Yeah, and he admits it. That's a good moment there when he admits it. And then, yeah, they start talking about getting, like, if he's going to, because he's like, you know, imagine if you had met her earlier and you had known all along, like, what if she was the princess all along and she was there? You could have already been engaged to her. And then he's like, yeah,
he's like, she wouldn't be the Cinder like, yeah, I know, but because she would have been raised by Lavanya,
right? So it would have been a lot different.
So the scene you were originally referring to is the Kai says, you can't expect the rest of your crew to want to stay on in a stolen ship. Thorne guffawed, my crew? Let me tell you what's going to become of my crew when this is over. Cinder will be the ruling monarch of a big rock in the sky. Iko will go wherever Cinder goes. So let's assume she becomes the queen's hairdresser or something. You, are you part of my crew? We both know where you're going to end up. And once we get Scarlet back, she and Wolf are going to return to some farm in France and have a litter of baby wolf cubs. Oh, so many laughter notes. I'm like trying not to laugh while reading that. And then.
I know, it's hilarious.
And then Kai says, I noticed you left Cress out. What's going on between you two anyways? Thorne laughed, nothing. She seems more comfortable around you than anybody else on the ship. And so this is where we first see Thorne have a reaction, because he's like, we were in the desert, but that's it. He doesn't, you know, she doesn't really care. She used to have a crush on me. Isn't that funny?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kai's like, hilarious. Right? Like, he knows that she's still done. Like, he can tell that Cress has a thing for Thorne, but Thorne's trying to, like, deny it. Although, what's really funny here, too, is that, you know, Thorne's like, oh, you know, it doesn't really matter. And Kai's like, it sort of matters. Yeah. I like Cress. I like you, too, despite my better judgment. And then Thorne's like, well, you'd be surprised how often I hear that. And then Kai says, something tells me Cress might still like you, too, against her better judgment.
And you know what I think is...
And Thorne's like...
What I think is great about Kai in his inner monologue, he says, somehow Thorne's inability to talk about his attraction to Cress spoke so much louder than an outright confession. After all, he had no trouble making suggestive commentary about Cinder.
Right. But you can't do that about Cress. And it's funny too, because Thorne's like, oh, it's complicated. And Kai's like, complicated.
I'll never understand that.
I don't know about complicated relationships.
I'm not falling in love with my fiance's niece. I wouldn't get that.
No. But the best part, no. But the best part of this conversation too, then, is when, you know, Thorne or Kai is, sorry, I'm going to start that over. The best part is that when, you know, Thorne tells Kai, you know, Kress was in love with this person who she made up in her head and was brave and selfless. And, you know, I kind of wish I was that guy. And, you know, and Kai's like, well, what makes you think you're not? And he's like, criminal, have you met me? And so Kai is just, you know, well, maybe you should stop putting so much energy into lamenting the fact that Kress was wrong about you and start putting your energy into proving her right, you know? And he's like, you are that person. And Thorne just can't grasp onto
And Kai that. Even says, but you do like her. And Thorne says, it doesn't matter. Going back to that self-preservation mechanism that we talked about earlier. And I think that I actually really appreciate what Thorne says about Kress in this moment, because the conversation on a surface level is Kai saying what's going to happen to your crew and Thorne coming up with what he feels like is going to happen to his crew, what he thinks would happen to them if they weren't in this circumstance. And he thinks that Kress would not want to be on the ship. She would want to be, she spent all her life in space. She wants to be on solid ground and on Earth and enjoying life. And I don't think that he's necessarily wrong about that assumption, but I do think that where they end up throughout the series, which is eventually the two of them are tasked with distributing the Letamosis antidote across the globe. And so they do have all these adventures together and they do fly around and Kress is, you know, sort of exposed to everything on Earth that she's always dreamed about. I do think that it speaks volumes that Thorne has even taken into consideration, not only what he thinks would happen to her, but like perhaps what he thinks is best for her. Not like what he would want, which is obviously to have them connected to each other, but like what would be better for Kress.
Right. Right. It's funny too, because he tells Kai, you know, she wants to travel and do all these things. And Kai's like, hello, she could stay with you and travel in your spaceship.
If only like you had a way to get her around point the
exactly.
world. So last question from Patreon. Maybe there isn't such a thing as fate. Maybe it's just opportunities we're given and what we do with them. I'm beginning to think that maybe great epic romances don't just happen. We have to make them ourselves. So what are our thoughts here? Is love all about chance? And how do Kress and Thorne take their chances at love? So I want to start with the first part of that, because I feel like we've talked a lot about like Kress and Thorne's chances at love and like how that happened. But like, do we think love is all about chance?
Mm-hmm.
I want to say something, let me explain something very complicated to you guys. I met Quentin working at Hardee's, but I think if you're going to talk about chance and fate and destiny, you have to ask, how did I end up at Hardee's? Well, I ended up at Hardee's because I had a job at McDonald's and the manager went through the drive-thru, thought I did a great job, offered me 5 cents more an hour. So I went to Hardee's. Well, why did I have a job at McDonald's? Well, my parents got divorced and my mom left me and I needed to have a job because I had to pay for an apartment. Well, why did my parents get divorced? Well, they were very unhappy for 15 years and they just got tired of it. Well, why did my parents get married in the first place? Like, so if you really want to backtrack, yes, it sounds like it's all up to chance, right? Because I had to get a job at Hardee's to meet Quentin, to fall in love, to get married. That couldn't have happened without meeting each other, and that's how we met each other. Mm-hmm. Now, you could argue that we lived in a town of 6,000 people, and we went to the same high school and the same community college, so we were probably going to run into each other at some point anyways. But in theory, the way that we met could be traced all the way back to why my parents got married when I was 3 months old. So, or even how my parents met, because I'm adopted. So if you want to pull it, if you want to pull the reins way back, then yes, you could argue that fate is involved. Because why did Quentin work in Hardee's? Well, he used to work at Dairy Queen with his sister, but all of his friends worked at Hardee's, and he was 16 and was like, I want to work my where my friends work, and went and got a job at Hardee's and was still there when he was in college. So why did he get a job at Dairy Queen? Because his sister already worked there and he wanted to pay for the gas in his Astro van that his parents let him drive. Like, there. So if you want to talk about like, how did you guys meet and you know, you want to dig a little deeper, I do think that a lot of that has to do with, you know, fate and destiny.
Yep.
But if you look at it that way, then every single solitary moment of our lives is controlled by destiny. And therefore, what we do with what happens to us is entirely on ourselves. So I kind of agree with Cress.
Right. I do too. And she says to him before she says that quote, she says, do you think it was destiny that brought us together? And he says, no, I'm pretty sure it was Cinder, which is funny, but he also like has a thoughtful moment actually. So he's actually kind of serious. But yeah, I mean, I agree with her too. Like, there are different opportunities, things that happen in our lives. And so you just, cause my husband and I met at a job also. And it was actually the worst job that I've ever had in my life. And I hated it there, but that's where we met. And, but it was like, you know, like the reason, like, why did I have that job was because I had just finished working for a theater company in Pennsylvania. I wanted to leave. I didn't want to spend another year with them, but I needed to save some money and figure out, you know, where I was going to go next. So I went back to stay with my mom for a year while I figured out if I was going to move to Chicago or New York City and try to save money. My cousins, two of my cousins and one of my cousin's best friend all worked at, it was ADT Security, the call center. And they all worked there and were like, oh, come on over and work here because it's so easy and it's a great job and you can save money. And so I got a job there. And then, you know, like that's where we met. And it was kind of crazy too, because we had shifts that were kind of opposite of each other. So our shifts only overlapped by 1 hour even. So we weren't even like, I don't know. So it was just, you know, all these different circumstances and things that happened. And I feel like I've actually thought about this before too, because listening to Taylor Swift gets me thinking about, you know, all of her songs about her other men and relationships and things then gets me thinking about my past ones. Right. And so like, yes. And well, even Timeless, thinking about Timeless, which just came out on Speak Now Taylor's version, you know, because she talks about how they were, even if they had met in 1944 or in 1958 or in the 1500s, how they would have found each other because mm-hmm. their love is timeless and they were supposed to be together. And I've thought about that too, like, well, what if I had done this with my life? Or what if I hadn't dated that person?
You know,
or I had gone to this job instead? Like, would we still have met?
And you know, I think that that's 100% true, because Quentin and I went to the same high school, and I knew three of his friends when I was in high school, and our paths didn't cross. We both went to the same junior college. We actually had a class together and didn't realize it, because there's like 60 people in that class, and it's college. You guys, I don't know if you guys have ever been to a junior college. It's basically just a big room. Some guy lectures for an hour, and you go home. Like, you do not talk to the people around you. It is not the same concept as high school, where you know everybody's name in your class. So, because they don't even take attendance. They're just like, you have a piece of paper you mm-hmm. sign, and then And then it's like, yep, she was in class that day because she signed her name. Like, nobody could forge that, whatever. So there are, like, there is a bubble of, like, well, you know, if Aaron had had a party, maybe I would have met him at the party. Maybe maybe he and I would have, I don't know, stood in line at the store at the high college together and actually paid attention. There are factors involved. And what I'd like to read really quickly for you guys, if you don't mind, is there's a comedian named Aziz Ansari. And I think he has a perfect little like bit that he does that explains how destiny impacts relationships. So here we go. He's talking about his friend who met his wife at Bed Bath & Beyond because they both had a gray Prius and he went to the wrong car. And so they got to talking and then this history. Think about all the random factors that had to come together to make this one moment possible that changed these two people's entire lives. First, this guy has to live in a particular town, then he has to have a Prius, but not just any Prius, it has to be a gray Prius of the same year. Then he has to need to go to Bed Bath & Beyond. Then he has to go to that particular Bed Bath & Beyond at the exact right time. Then there has to be another guy who also lives in that town, also drives a gray Prius of the same year, also has to go to Bed Bath & Beyond at the exact same time and the exact same location. And they have to park somewhat near each other so that you could mistake the car. And my friend had to leave before the other person left so that they could cross paths at the exact same moment and be at their cars at the exact same time. That is a huge list of what if he had gotten there 5 minutes late? What if he decided to go to the bathroom before he went home? What if he was smart enough to know which car was his? Like,
right?
The amount of fact, I have a friend
who there's had so much
in a very similar way. She had a bottle of soda in a parking lot. She dropped it. It rolled under his car and she was like under his car trying to get the bottle. And he was like, yo, what's up? And they are married and have
two. Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. So,
I have to say that there is something to be said about destiny. However, I think you could apply that to every aspect of your entire life, all the way back to when I was born, because my parents had to have similar circumstances so that they could boink one out and have me. So, you know what I mean? Like, because it's not just how did I fall in love,
yes.
How did my parents fall in love? And how did their parents fall in love so they
right.
give birth to those people? Like, if we try to backtrack this stuff, it is the tangent that will never end. And it is basically the entire story of life and your existence. And so do I think fate has some, what I'm trying to say in a very big way, I guess, in a very like circle is, yes, I do think fate is involved. However, I think fate is involved with everything in your life, not just relationships. And so Cress is 100% right. It is about what we do for ourselves. We have to make things work for ourselves. It is how we take advantage of the scenarios that the chance and destiny and fate of life provide us that actually give us our, quote, epic romance and happily ever after.
I agree as well.
So it's a big long way of saying that.
It is, but it's all right. It gives everybody some more to think about.
Right? Okay, so for all of you who haven't fallen in love yet, don't worry. You just need to have to go to the same store at the same time with the same car. Like, or drop your water bottle or get a job. Like, there are, if you haven't fallen in love yet and you're lonely and you're like sad and stuff, because I had that. There was a time in my life where I was like, I'm never getting married. No one will ever love me. So like, if you ever are in that like zone Same. In your brain, don't worry, because it's coming. It's just, there's so many variables and factors that have to line up at the exact moment. Mm-hmm. It'll just be super impressive when it does happen.
Yes. And then you will find your timeless love.
But that is it for Questwell. That is all of the questions we had. Thank you so much to Patreon for taking the time to go on the Discord to chat about this couple, to give us all these wonderful questions to discuss. This is going to be on the Prince Kai Fam Pod Patreon page. It's also going to be on the YA Book Chat page, right? Two birds, one stone.
Yeah, of course.
So Yeah. So whether you're listening from the Prince Kai Fan Pod Patreon or the YA Book Chat Patreon, thank you. We appreciate you. This is great.
Yay. Those were really fantastic questions too. So
yeah,
your patrons who submitted those questions did a fantastic job.
They really did. They really did. And all, as always, if you have listened to this entire episode, please email me, princekaifanpod@gmail.com, for your free Cresswell digital bookmark. I don't know if you know this, Leah, but every single bonus episode that I do, I make a digital bookmark for. And I tell people at the very end, like, look, if you listened to this whole episode, that means that you listened to an entire bonus episode. So thank you, because it means it was a good thing that I recorded it. So now you get a bookmark as a thank you. So whether you're on Leah's Patreon or awesome. My Patreon, you can email me princekaifanpod@gmail.com and I will send you a Cresswell bookmark that I designed. I'll send you a digital bookmark.
Awesome.
It's the only way I know if anybody listens to my episodes. Also, so far, Sierra is the only one who's ever emailed me. So thank you, Sierra. You're probably listening. You're the best. I know you listened. I appreciate you.
Yay. Maybe other people just don't remember to email about the bookmark.
Or they just don't care. I don't know.
I don't know.
Okay, so is there anything you wanted to say before we sign off? We'll be doing another one in a few weeks, probably, because this is going to be like my segment thing for bonus episodes.
Which I think is super fun. I really, really love that. This is a really fun thing to do. Now, see, I can't do that because I have so many different books
of the books you've already covered.
I could do. I don't know. But this was really fun. I'm glad that we got to talk about this because I'm telling you, Cresswell, oh my goodness, absolute favorite ship of like all time.
Oh, I love
them so much. So yeah, this was really fun.
I love it. That's perfect. All right. Well, thank you guys so much for being here and for all of these wonderful questions and for being Patreon members. At the end of bonus episodes, I like to say something different than don't get glamored. But I'm not really sure what to say in terms of a relationship episode. So what I'm going to say is love yourself first and the rest will fall into place later.
That's good.
No one is ever going to love you as much as you love yourself.
That is very true.
Mm-hmm.
Amen.
All right, bye guys. Thanks for being here.
Bye.